Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And it's here now, finally, after months of hearing from pundits and politicians and us, the American people, have their say. Democrats hoping to change the course and take the House. Republicans hoping to keep the Senate and stay the course that the president has laid out since 2016. It is a big day. In some parts of Georgia where there's a hot governor's race, the wait at polling places was 3 hours long this morning. People had to leave. So what should we be looking for as day goes into night? NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson is here. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
And just your overarching thought about this day and the turnout we're seeing?
Well, that's the most significant big news about today. We might be on track to have the biggest turnout midterm election since 1966, and that would be really something. And that would probably be good for Democrats because usually they stay home in midterms and Republicans are very reliable voters. So it sounds like what we're hearing anecdotally around the country, big long lines, lots of minorities, lots of millennials. That could change the look of the midterm electorate.
Well, and as we know, anything can happen. We want everybody to just go and vote in whatever way they want. But what should we be watching? We're told, for instance, to watch in Kentucky a race pitting third-term Republican Andy Barr against the Democrat and military vet Amy McGrath. There's two Virginia races to watch, New Jersey's third. Which races do you think and why?
Well, the House races that I think are important to watch, I think that Kentucky one is important. First of all, the polls close there at 6 o'clock, so at least it's an early one. But you want to look at districts that should be Republican. In other words, that's a Republican district. If Amy McGrath, who's a vet, can win, that might signal that there's a blue wave. If you look at some of the Virginia races, for instance, those polls close at 7 o'clock. Dave Brat versus Spanberger, that's another district that has been Republican for an incredibly long time. Remember, Dave Brat was the guy who pulled off the incredible feat of defeating Eric Cantor, the majority leader, the Republican majority leader, in a primary. If that goes Democratic, that will tell you something.
That's Virginia's
10th. Right.
There
are two races in New York, upstate New York, Brindisi versus Claudia Tenney, who's the Republican incumbent. There's a race on Staten Island. You want to look at races that should be Republican. And if Republicans are having a hard time hanging on to them, then you know something's going on.
Yeah, the New Jersey's third, which people are looking at, is the incumbent Tom MacArthur and the Democrat Andy Kim. Florida's 26th, Republican Carlos Curbelo in a tight race with the Democrat Debbie Mercarsel Powell.
Now, that would be a good test of whether a Republican, Curbelo, who has distanced himself from Trump, he's done a very different approach than most Republicans. He's actually distanced himself from Trump. He is Hispanic in a Hispanic district. If he can hang on, it shows you that there is a path for people who are not huge Trump fans in the Republican Party to prevail.
And briefly, there are always seats that change hands in the midterms. So put this in context. What would be a big win for Democrats?
Well, I define success for Democrats as taking the House back and making big gains in the governor's races and state legislative races and minimizing their losses in the Senate. That's my definition of success for them.
The majority of early voters in Georgia, where there's a big governor's race, Texas, Florida, another governor's race, Tennessee, Nevada, have been women. Your thoughts on that?
Well, this is the year of the woman. I'm old enough to have covered the first one in 1992, but this one is much bigger. It really, 92 pales in comparison to this. You have women who really have been the rocket fuel of this election. Not only have they marched and organized and gone to town meetings and voted, but they've also run. We have a record number of female candidates running for House and Senate. The vast majority of them are Democrats, but no matter what happens tonight, in January, state legislatures around the country and the Congress of the United States will look more female.
And for many in the women's races, as we've heard from their stories, it's personal. I'm thinking of the Michigan congressional candidate, Alyssa Slotkin. Her mother had died of cancer because she let her health care lapse and didn't renew it. And then Slotkin was watching on TV when her representative, Mike Bishop, was there as there was an attempt to overturn Obamacare. And she turned to her husband and said, "That's it. I'm running."
At least that's what her—and that's certainly what her ads show.
That's what the story says. Yeah.
That's certainly what her ad showed. That's the narrative she's telling. But that has been the Democrats' consistent message. Healthcare, which is amazing since they suffered because of Obamacare in two midterm elections. Now Obamacare is working for them because people do not want to lose that coverage for pre-existing conditions. And that's what repealing Obamacare without a replacement would do. And that's what all those lawsuits that the Trump administration is supporting and state attorney generals all over the country who are Republican are pursuing to try to get out of that requirement.
Well, on the Republican side and the ardent Trump supporting side, we have the constant reminder of what he calls the caravan and the wall and the situation with illegal immigrants and the ad that featured an undocumented immigrant who did kill two police. And in that ad, the president or who put the ad, whoever put the ad together, blaming Democrats. Fox News pulling that ad, which many people thought was racist. And then you have that interview that President Trump gave with Sinclair Broadcasting. He was asked if he had a regret in this election season.
I would say tone. I would like to have a much softer tone. I feel to a certain extent I have no choice, but maybe I do. And maybe I could have been softer from that standpoint.
That's on election eve. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I haven't read the whole transcript of that interview, but White House officials are saying that the whole transcript shows that he isn't regretful about what he's done. They felt that was taken out of context. The president isn't someone who does regrets generally. He generally doubles down. He doesn't make tactical retreats. But the fact that he was talking about having a softer tone is interesting because up until now, his strategy has been to be as divisive as possible because that's what gins up his base. That's what worked for him in 2016. And focus on issues, culture war, emotional issues like race, crime, and immigration.
We have to leave it at that. Mara Liasson, NPR national political correspondent. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, abortion can be a litmus test for voters. They choose the candidate who supports their views. But while the politics of abortion have barely budged since Roe v. Wade, technology around abortion is changing. And as Madeline Beck of Illinois Newsroom reports, that's having an impact on the debate.
This story is not about the ethics of abortion. Instead, it's about how technology may influence people's access and decisions. Some of that technology is already out there, like in Planned Parenthood's Iowa City Clinic. It looks more like a small office than a patient room. There are tables, chairs, a laptop, a cash register. The room is for telemedicine abortions. That's where women speak with a physician over a computer screen. The physician reviews patient health information, they talk, and if all parties want to move forward, the doctor remotely unlocks the cash register that has abortion medication for one person.
This is just that modified cash drawer technology. These are normal cash drawers.
That's Rachel Goss of Planned Parenthood of the Heartland. She says her organization pioneered a version of this technology 10 years ago. It gives women access to abortion in areas where physicians working in abortion clinics and physicians in general are sparse. But 19 states have banned the technology. If other states ban abortion in the future and more women head to Iowa clinics with telemedicine, Goss says,
I do think it would actually help us meet the need and demand.
And either side of that loaded issue, for abortion rights or against, we'll be using telemedicine technology and many others to push forward the abortion debate.
We are able to use those same technologies for pro-life reasons.
That's Mary-Kate Knorr, director of Illinois Right to Life. She says clinics that perform abortions may use technology in one way, but her organization uses social media and live streaming video for their purposes.
To reach those same women, to talk to them about their other options, to talk to them about adoption, to talk to them about the various resources that we are able to provide.
Nora says new ultrasound technology and detailed images inside the womb help their mission, too.
Ultrasounds allow women to actually see something that they couldn't see before.
At Planned Parenthood, Rachel Goss says seeing the ultrasounds have convinced some women to change their mind about abortion, but anecdotally, not a large percentage. Ultrasounds may influence people's decisions in another way, though.
It's incredible what we're able to see now versus, 20, 30 years ago.
That's Dr. Andrew Satin. He's director of gynecology and obstetrics at Johns Hopkins Medicine. He also sees how technology could affect women's decisions around abortion. Doctors can now see, diagnose, and sometimes cure health issues in the womb that they couldn't have a few decades ago using better imaging like ultrasounds, new tiny instruments, and genetics.
I think those are all tremendous technologic advances that will allow us to diagnose things, to be able to counsel patients accurately, and hopefully to treat more things, but also to inform them when we can't treat more things so they can make informed decisions.
And there are plenty of other technologies to factor in, too, like contraception apps to prevent pregnancy and, a ways down the road, drones that could deliver abortion medication to women's homes. Activists have already used them that way abroad in Northern Ireland and Poland. Goss, with Planned Parenthood, says her organization has to comply with state and national laws which restrict abortion medications' use and distribution. But they still want to keep expanding access with technology.
It's just, how can we do that, continue to remain compliant, continue to, you know, serve our patients as well as we can.
But for her clinic and for the anti-abortion movement, the real technology that's affecting abortion now is the internet. As access to abortion changes, women can go online, ask questions, and find answers to whatever they might be looking for. For Here and Now, I'm Madeline Beck.
An Illinois Newsroom is a public radio collaboration covering state education, politics, health, and the environment. Let's continue our conversation now with astronaut Scott Kelly, who's just published Infinite Wonder. It's a book of photographs he took from his year at the International Space Station. Yesterday, we talked with Kelly about how his time on the space station affected his body and his relationship with his then-fiancé, now-wife, Amiko. I asked Kelly what lessons were learned from his experience that might be applied to a human mission to Mars.
You know, I think we learned a lot about, you know, human physiology and performance by being in space for longer than we, you know, normally do this. People have – Russian cosmonauts have spent longer time on the space station Mir, but we have a much more significant capability to do science and collect data. So I think we learned some things from a human performance and physiology perspective that will help us go to Mars someday. But, you know, what I learned is that, you know, me personally, my personal takeaway from this experience, spending a year in space, but also just being a part of NASA and this incredible organization, is that we have the capacity to do amazing things, things that are incredibly complicated, difficult, challenging, if we choose to do them. So, you know, my biggest takeaway from this experience was that we need to have big goals, and if we work together, we can solve them.
You think we're going to go to Mars in your lifetime?
I don't know. I hope so. I know we can if we choose to. I'm just not sure whether we have the if we're going to make that choice. I hope we do. It's. I'll quote my brother here. He says something that I think makes a whole lot of sense. I don't say that often about him, but it was a joke, obviously. I think he listens to NPR, so I'll be careful. But he says it's not about you know, getting to Mars is not about rocket science. It's about political science, and I think that's very true.
Your missions to the International Space Station relied a lot on the Russians. You trained at the Russian Center, Star City. You were launched and landed from Russia using Russian technology. Are you at all worried that with the tensions on the ground between Russia and the United States that the future of that relationship could negatively impact space exploration?
Well, I'm not worried about it. I think it's something that is always possible. You know, if our political climate between our two countries was to get worse, I would think it would have to get much worse because, you know, this is what's great about the space program. It gives you this place, this incredible place to work in a collaborative nature on a neutral playing field on something that is very, very important to both of our countries and even, you know, other countries as well as, you know, being part of this international partnership. So I think the international aspect of spaceflight is incredibly important. I think it often transcends politics, and it never, you know, any kind of disagreement or conflict between, you know, the United States and Russia never, in my experience, and I'm pretty sure I could probably speak for my colleagues, has never come between the crew members in space because, you know, we absolutely rely on each other for, you know, literally for our lives, for emotional support, for friendship, for, you know, support doing our work.
You ever talk politics with each other up there?
A little bit, but when I was on the space station, it's when this last time was when Russia first entered Syria, and there was concern that there could actually, you know, maybe even be, you know, an accident where you have, you know, the U.S. military in an armed conflict, a skirmish, you know, not something large, but with the Russian military. It's something we talked about a little bit, but it was almost like, you know, because we're in space on the space station working together as a team, it's almost like when we would talk about that, we were talking about two different countries that weren't our own. Like, you know, we were talking about Germany and China versus the United States and Russia.
If there is a little kid listening to this right now somewhere in America and they want to be an astronaut, what would you tell them?
Well, first thing I would tell them is, you know, congratulations for listening to NPR, little kid.
There That's are impressive. Some little kids, I guarantee it, who listen. I meet them sometimes.
But, you know, for kids that want to be an astronaut, I would say it's possible because I was this kid that, you know, was not a good student. I wasn't interested in school. Yet I found my own inspiration from a book. The book was The Right Stuff, which inspired me to try to become an astronaut and fly in space. And I would say that, you know, if I can do it, a lot of other people can do it too. And, you know, those kids out there today might be the kids that go to Mars.
I want to ask you one more question, Scott Kelly, about some of the photographs in your book, and that would be the photos of zinnias, flowers. This is one of the science projects you were doing at the space station. First of all, just tell us about that. Why were you taking pictures of these flowers?
Well, there's all different kinds of experiments on the space station, but some of them have to do with plant growth and, you know, whether we can cultivate more complex plants for use on a, you know, an extended mission, perhaps to Mars someday, whether, you know, those plants are for food or other purposes. So we started out growing some lettuce, and then the next more complicated thing was a flowering plant, a zinnia. For some reason, they chose zinnias. But I, you know, I became very serious about those flowers when I took a picture of my flowers, and they weren't looking too good, and I posted it on Instagram.
And somebody said you were no Mark Watney.
Exactly.
Being the botanist in The Martian who grows potatoes on Mars.
That person threw down the gauntlet.
Right. And so, what'd you do?
So I was really motivated to out Mark Watney. And, but, you know, it was interesting because how NASA research works, I would take pictures of the flowers and then they would, because of the bureaucracy and being told when to water them or not water them, the flowers were completely out of phase with NASA bureaucracy, and they were either watered too much or watered too little until that person called me out on Instagram. And then I'm like, okay, I'm taking this project over myself. Mm-hmm. I'm going to touch the leaves and, you know, determine as basically as if I was like an earthbound gardener whether these plants needed water or not and not you know, have to wait for the system to respond. And that seemed to work pretty well. And I was happy that NASA took my suggestion and decided that would be the better way to go.
Have you been gardening since you've been back on Earth?
I'd like to say yes, but I have to say no, I've not. I've been too busy to garden.
That is Scott Kelly, whose new book is called Infinite Wonder, An Astronaut's Photograph from a Year in Space. His memoir, Endurance, is also out in paperback. There's a kid's version as well. Scott Kelly, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And as we change gears now and check in on how voting is going today, I'll ask the question, Houston, do we have a problem? Laura Eisensee is a reporter for Houston Public Media. She's in Texas's 7th Congressional District, which includes parts of Houston and its western suburbs. She's at a polling station in Houston. I was kidding there, Laura. I'm sure there's no problem. Or is there? What's the mood like at the polls today?
Well, I would say the mood, I've been to several polls, and I would say the mood is very focused. Voters seem to know what they want, who they want to vote for, and they have a mission and they want to get it done here in Houston. Earlier today, we saw some longer lines. I'd say right now it's kind of slower, but it's still very steady turnout here.
Mm-hmm. And the race that a lot of people have been watching all around the country that's happening in Texas is the Senate race between the incumbent Republican Ted Cruz and the Democrat Beto O'Rourke. Is that what's driving most people to the polls today?
That is definitely one that is getting people out to vote. I mean, you could call it a blockbuster race. And I've talked with some younger voters who, and also some older voters who want to see a change. They want to see a Democrat representing Texas in the Senate.
Let's listen to one of the voters that you talked to today. This is Dwayne Mollard.
I'm very conservative, so I want to vote that viewpoint, and so that's what I came and do to keep us on track with what we're doing.
Keep us on track with what we're doing. What else are you hearing from voters?
I'm hearing that women's rights are on their minds. One voter told me that she had never voted in a midterm election before. She had only voted in presidential elections. But after the hearings for now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, she wanted to come out and vote because she felt very strongly about women's rights. I also heard, I've been hearing that immigration is very much on people's minds, and they want to express their views on that, too.
The district that you're in also has a closely watched House race. Democrat Lizzie Fletcher is trying to unseat the Republican incumbent John Culberson. I remember when we were reporting from Texas earlier this year that many people I was talking to didn't know who was running for their House race, but they certainly knew whether they were going to go Democrat or Republican. Are you hearing from people about that House race?
I am. I've been at several polls in the district, and you know it's kind of mixed. Some people say they are pretty satisfied with Culberson. They may not agree with every way he's voted, but they want to keep that limited government. And then again, I'm hearing from several people, you know, in this district that's traditionally very Republican, that they want to change. They want to change the direction. They want a fresh, younger voice.
Laura Eisensee at a polling place in Houston. Thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The sun rose at 6:24 a.m. this morning where we are. It is rising at earlier times because daylight saving time ended over the weekend in most of the country. And now our schedules and bodies are trying to adjust. Eric Herzog is professor at Washington University and president of the Society for Research on Biological Rhythms. Professor, I was out walking my dog the day after the time change at 6 o'clock in the morning, and there were tons of people out because everyone was getting up earlier than they had been. Why does 1 hour make such a difference?
Well, 1 hour is noticeable to all of us, and so in that sense, it makes a big difference. We feel great that we've got that extra hour of sleep, but in the long term, this 1 hour cumulatively can really have effects on our health.
What do you mean?
So when we live on standard time, our bodies have an internal clock called a circadian clock that is has evolved to synchronize to that schedule of the sun rising and setting every day. When we mess with that clock, for example, when we're on shift work schedules or we fly across time zones, we can often feel jet lag or even worse, certain forms of depression and other bad health consequences.
How long does it take to get over that?
It has to do with how big a time shift we're trying to accomplish. So if you fly one time zone east, generally it'll take folks 1 or 2 days to get on the new schedule. If you fly one time zone west, folks actually adjust even a little bit faster for reasons that are still not totally clear.
Hmm.
But when it comes to daylight saving time or the fall back, there's really nothing in the environment that changed. It's just the clock on the wall that changed. And so how do we accomplish that shift when, in fact, our environment hasn't changed at all?
Do you find that people make any adjustments in the long term to their schedule once they experience something different with the time change? For example, if on Sunday night, the day after the time change, you end up going to sleep earlier, you end up getting up earlier the next morning just because you haven't adjusted yet. And then you say, oh, well, this is nice. I can get some work done. I can have more time for my breakfast in the morning, or I get more sleep at night if I go to bed a little bit earlier. Do people make changes like that in the long term based on just that 1 hour difference?
Yeah. What we see is in the data, when we fall back, there's about 1 day during which folks are enjoying that extra hour of sleep. That effect lasts for about 1 day. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that in the spring, when we spring ahead, there's bigger effects and they last for longer that are mostly detrimental. So things like 3 days of increased heart attacks, increased chances of being in a car accident. Hmm. And during daylight saving time, there's now pretty good evidence that we're actually chronically more sleep deprived than when we're on standard time.
So you are in favor of us staying on standard time all the time. But let me ask you this, given the situation as it exists today, do you prefer to fall back or to spring forward?
I do enjoy that extra hour of sleep on the fall back. I'm an extreme early bird myself and a relatively short sleeper. And I just live on a regular schedule with the natural light that I experience.
That is Eric Herzog, who's a professor of biology and neuroscience at Washington University in St. Louis and president of the Society for Research on Biological Rhythms. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
I'm a spring forward person. I always like it when the sun sets at like 8:30.
For nearly a century after the U.S. government overthrew the Kingdom of Hawaii in 1893, Olelo Hawaii, the indigenous native language spoken by Hawaiians, was banned in public schools. That ban remained on the books until 1978, and today there are fewer than 300 native speakers. But now the popular language learning app Duolingo is making it possible to learn the language for free on your smartphone. Here's an example of phrases in the app's 5-minute lessons. How to greet someone and introduce yourself.
Aloha kāua.
Aloha. Pehea kāua.
Mai ka iwaia.
How to talk about your family and where you're from.
O ka iulani kona tūtū wahine.
No molokai ko umakua kāne.
No o ahu kona anakala.
He kumu ko o anakala.
Aikala Kaneopio Crozier is a Hawaiian language teacher who helped Duolingo develop its Olelo Hawaii curriculum. Aikala, aloha awinala.
Aloha no, pēhā oi. How are you?
I'm fine. What did we just say?
You just said greetings and I said same to you. And how are you?
I'm just fine. And this is so much fun, but also very serious. It's just stunning to hear that indigenous Hawaiians were not allowed to speak their native language. Is this something that's been, I would think, a festering issue there?
Well, yeah, it has had a great impact on our people because for generations, Hawaiians were not able to speak their language. They were actually severely punished for speaking their language and convinced that it would be best to give it up and speak English. So in many families, they didn't carry on their language.
Are there generations who are speaking it in homes?
Well, you know, we started in 1985 with Punana Leo. They were little Hawaiian language preschools to start with, you know, revitalizing and renormalizing our language through our children. And so now we're seeing those children who are now in their 30s raising their children in the Hawaiian language. So yes, recently we have at least two generations now that are fluent in the language.
Well, let's hear some of it. You've been working since then, the 1980s, to make it more accessible. And here's a clip from a video lesson you recorded back in 1994.
Here we have the question. Makemake oi ika laulau? Makemake oi ika laulau? And the response to that is, aye, yes, makemake o I ka lau lau.
And what does that mean?
It asks, do you want lau lau? And the response is, yes, I want a lau lau. And lau lau is hard to translate because it's a Hawaiian food. And basically, it's tea leaves wrapped around taro leaves. And sometimes there's meat and fish in it. So it's like a little Hawaiian bento.
So this is, you know, it's complicated as any language is. What did you have to consider? You were part of the team that now has brought this from the classrooms in Hawaii to the Duolingo app. What were some of the things that you had to consider?
Yeah, I think, you know, when we're thinking about the app, we're looking at what's most important to people. What do they want to talk about? Because we're not trying to teach them grammar and get really, you know, detailed in the language. So, you know, our first group of people that we want to make sure we serve on this app are families who are raising their children in Hawaiian language so they can communicate with these children. Of course, there's greetings, there's talking about family, there's talking about food, things that are relevant to raising your children, but in small bites.
Is part of this about maybe Hawaiians wanting to take back sort of a depth that was removed when the U.S. overthrew the kingdom in 1893 and banned the language? Because we tend to have this caricature of Hawaiians, some mainland Americans do, that the hula is practiced. But beyond that, they don't want to go any deeper.
Yeah, definitely. I think more importantly than ensuring that everyone else knows is starting with our own selves, that we know that we're more than just the rhetorical reproduction of who we are to the world. And that hula, yeah, in its basic form, can only be danced properly if you know the language. And it's storytelling, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's providing that depth of understanding who we are, why we do what we do, why we think the way we do. And our whole worldview is wrapped up in the words that we speak. So it is important to find that depth and breadth. And I think for us, Duolingo provides that opportunity to get people started. It doesn't take the place of a classroom. This is to get people excited, interested, maybe put aside some anxiety and fear. But eventually, the hope is that they would be strong enough and feel like they have enough to know that they can actually engage in a class, engage with other people, and really step out and start to use it in a practical way, you know?
Yeah. There's a weekly radio news report in Hawaiian. People are pasting the Hawaiian over the English in some books for kids. But you say that the language and the words also can help people understand who Hawaiians are. Can you give me an example of a word that is much more than a word?
Oh, yeah, we have so many. We have in our language what's called kauna. And it's the hidden meaning of a word, or a second meaning that's deeper. And so you see them show up a lot in poetry, you know. So when we say something like a simple line like palike kua mahina kealo, says that the back is straight as a cliff and the face is like a moon. You know, those kinds of words tells us how our people thought. You know, that when they looked at you, posture and position was really important. If you don't understand it in the context that it said, it's hard to make sense of that, right? The back is a cliff and the face is a moon. But when you understand the people and what it means to them, all of that makes total sense. That our cliffs are very straight and that's how our back should be. Our face should be as bright as the moon. Always shining, you know? So that's just a small example of that depth of our language that tells us the way they thought and the way they perceived the world.
Ekela Kaniopio Crozier is a Hawaiian language teacher. She helped Duolingo develop its new Olelo Hawaii curriculum, the language of Hawaii. We'll link you to it at herenow.org. Ekela, mahalo.
Mahalo.
Thank you. this grace note, the remains of Major Brent Taylor arrived back in the U.S. today. The 39-year-old mayor of North Ogden, Utah, and National Guardsman and father, was killed in Afghanistan on Saturday. His body arrived at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware around 4 o'clock this morning when what the military calls a dignified transfer took place, a solemn ceremony in which an Army carry team, pallbearers, lifted a metal case holding Taylor's remains from the plane and carried it to a waiting van. His widow Jenny then spoke.
I personally cannot yet find words adequate to tell you all that I feel as I stand here this morning by the dawn's early light. And so I echo the words someone recently shared with me. Brent may have died on Afghan soil, but he died for the success of freedom and democracy in both of our countries. It seems only fitting that Brent, who in death now represents something so much greater than any of our own individual lives, has come home to U.S. soil in a flag-draped casket on our election day. It is a timeless and cherished honor to serve in our country's armed services. That honor has been Brent's as he served in the Utah National Guard for the past 15 years, and it has been mine for just as long as I have proudly stood by his side. And it has been and will continue to be the great honor of our 7 children for the rest of their lives, and I pray for many generations to come.
How did she get through that? Jenny Taylor, widow of Major Brent Taylor. And by the way, in his last Facebook post before he was killed, Major Taylor urged Americans to exercise what he called their precious right to vote.
Brazil's president-elect Jair Bolsonaro says China is welcome to invest in his country and that trade between Brazil and China could grow. His remarks in a TV interview yesterday contrasted with his campaign when he depicted China as a predator seeking to dominate key sectors of Brazil's economy. Bolsonaro is a far-right former army captain who capitalized on voter discontent with corruption to win the October 28th election in Brazil. A corruption scandal led to the impeachment of one president and a jail sentence for another. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton praised Bolsonaro as a like-minded leader to President Trump in a speech last week. Joining us now from Rio de Janeiro is NPR international correspondent Philip Reeves. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
So it has been just a week now since Bolsonaro won the election, but he's already making waves. Start by telling us about his decision to name the judge who jailed his main rival for the presidency to serve as his justice minister.
Yes, this is Sergio Moro. He is the star judge among a group of prosecutors and judges involved in the what's called the car wash investigation, in which basically top Brazilian politicians were getting payoffs from big business in return for contracts and political favors. This made Sergio Moro extremely popular, his role in this. You see T-shirts with his face on it. They made a movie about him. There are books about the operation and about his role in it. And one of the people that he wound up jailing for corruption is Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, the former president of Brazil, Lula, as everybody calls him. He was jailed in Moro's court last year, and then early this year, that conviction was upheld, and that meant that Lula was banned from participating in the election, from running for a third term. So critics of Bolsonaro were saying, wait a minute, what's this? Moro wasn't, in fact, impartial, that this is part of a political plot to keep Lula from running for a third term. But I should say that many Brazilians who voted for Bolsonaro, not necessarily from the far right either, are so concerned about corruption and crime that they're glad to see Sergio Moro in government because they hope that he will be able to do something about it. Whether he'll actually be able to do that is another issue.
Now, Bolsonaro also announced that he is going to move Brazil's embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, something the United States recently did. And this is something that Bolsonaro campaigned on. How is that going to go over in Brazil? Is that something that people want him to do?
Well, interestingly, he's not, it seems, primarily come under pressure to do this from the Jewish communities of Brazil, but it is something that is very popular with the evangelicals, who are a big part of his political base. That said, there is an element in this society that isn't so happy, and it's the meat trade. Brazil exports a very large amount of halal meat to Islamic countries, and there's concern within the trade that because of this decision, they will suffer for that.
A lot of people have compared Bolsonaro to President Trump. Now, President Trump has been compared to other people around the world, other leaders that have come up around the world. But in this case, Bolsonaro has used the term fake news. He does seem to do a lot of the things that President Trump does. Is it a fair comparison?
In some respects, it certainly is, yeah. I mean, but it must be said that Bolsonaro served in the military. He's not a millionaire. But there are certainly some similarities. His use of social media is one of them. He directly communicates with his supporters. The cry of fake news that you mentioned is a typical Trump tactic that Bolsonaro frequently uses. His belief also that criminal violence should be met with violence. Bolsonaro is keen to enable the police to use still more lethal force against suspects, much to the concern of civil rights groups. And he also has a record of making outrageous remarks. In Bolsonaro's case, these have denigrated women, homosexuals, and Afro-Brazilians.
What is the relationship going to be like with the United States? We mentioned John Bolton, the president's national security advisor, saying that Bolsonaro is a like-minded leader to President Trump.
It will be a very close relationship. Bolsonaro says that he wants to move geopolitically towards the U.S., and he has openly expressed his admiration for Donald Trump on many occasions. And one area where it really is significant is Venezuela. You know, Brazil is right next to Venezuela. The U.S. is keen to apply more pressure on Venezuela and the regime of Nicolas Maduro. Now they'll have, as you say, a like-minded president in Brazil, the biggest nation in Latin America. So that could make it a little easier in complicated conditions for the U.S. to apply pressure on Venezuela.
Any thought that he may try to unite the country after this election? Obviously, there are a lot of people who are angry that he won.
The country is very divided. It's going to be very difficult to unite the country, especially when you look at some of the policies that Bolsonaro espouses. That said, he is certainly trying to send a message of unity. He's been talking about the fact that he respects the Constitution amid concerns that his authoritarian politics might be a threat to it, and also the need to protect democracy here. So his message is certainly one of unity, but his deeds will be what he's judged by.
That's NPR's Philip Reeves joining us from Rio de Janeiro. Philip, thank you.
You're welcome.
So, Robin, the results from Rio are the only ones we have so far.
Right.
Still waiting on the ones in this country.
We're standing by them.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
It's election day. Go out and vote. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.